Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Clovis Oncology, we had the pleasure of speaking with Robert L. Coleman, MD, FACOG, FACS, Chief Scientific Officer of the U.S. Oncology Network, and Jubilee Brown, MD, a Professor and Associate Director of Gynecologic Oncology at the Levine Cancer Institute of Atrium Health, to discuss BRCA positivity and the use of PARP inhibitors in patients with ovarian cancer following an announcement that the confirmatory ARIEL-4 study met its primary endpoint. In December 2020, Clovis Oncology released a statement indicating that rucaparib was found to result in a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival compared with chemotherapy in patients with BRCA mutant ovarian cancer who had previously received two or more lines of chemotherapy in the Phase 3 ARIEL-4 trial. At the 2021 SGO Virtual Annual Meeting on Women's Cancer, primary findings from the ARIEL-4 trial were presented. The results showed that the investigator-assessed median PFS in the efficacy population was 7.4 months with rucaparib versus 5.7 months with chemotherapy. Among the 23 patients with a BRCA reversion mutation, the median PFS in the rucaparib arm was 2.9 months versus 5.5 months in the chemotherapy arm. The median duration of response in the efficacy population was 9.4 months with rucaparib versus 7.2 months with chemotherapy. In December 2016, rucaparib was approved by the FDA for the treatment of patients with advanced ovarian cancer who have a deleterious BRCA mutation and who have been treated with two or more chemotherapy regimens. The indication received an accelerated approval based on two multi-center single-arm Phase 1-2 clinical trials. The ARIEL-4 trial was designed to be the confirmatory Phase 3 trial to further prove the benefit of rucaparib for this indication and was created in consultation with the FDA and the European Medicines Agency. In our exclusive interview, Coleman and Brown explained how understandings of BRCA and patient eligibility for PARP inhibitors has evolved in ovarian cancer, discussed the effects of frontline maintenance trials on treatment recommendations, detailed the clinical significance of the findings from the ARIEL-4 trial, and forecasted where PARP inhibition is headed in the field. Dr. Coleman, anecdotally speaking, how would you say PARP inhibitors have affected patients with ovarian cancer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think probably if you look back among the agents that have actually impacted the therapeutic approach to ovarian cancer, this is probably the biggest thing since certainly paclitaxel, but maybe even bevacizumab. It's one of the very few examples of a drug linked to a predictive and prognostic biomarker. Which in this case is BRCA. So we're so excited to see this rapidly be developed, first in the recurrent setting and then now in the frontline setting.
I absolutely agree. I think this has been a complete game changer for our patients with ovarian, tubal, and peritoneal cancer. You know, in the past, we had very limited options to guide our patients in terms of both frontline and recurrent settings. And now we have a way to really impact their prognosis and even potentially their cure rate long-term in a way that really that gives them a much better outlook and has really minimal side effects long-term.
So then, Dr. Brown, how would you say our understanding of BRCA and patient eligibility for PARP inhibitors has evolved?
Well, I think it's changed a lot. And in fact, over the last couple of years, we've all changed the way that we manage our patients. So even counseling our patients up front when we see them with newly diagnosed disease, now we always talk about germline and somatic testing. We test all of our patients up front because knowing those BRCA and BRCA-related mutation status situations for our patients really impacts everything we do in terms of management. You know, do we give patients PARP inhibitors up front? How do we manage them? What's their prognosis? And even in a recurrent setting, how we use that information to guide the use of PARP inhibitors.
Dr. Coleman, would you say that there are clear pathways for who should and should not receive a PARP inhibitor at this point?
Yeah, I think the easy answer to that question is should. We know because of the, as I mentioned before, the relationship between a predictive biomarker and outcome, that patients who have a mutation in BRCA1 and 2 genes, and maybe some of the other homologous recombination repair genes that are mutated, like PALB2 and RAD51C and D and others, are patients that we've demonstrated, you know, kind of the cause and effect, that those patients have tumors that shrink under these therapies. We've broadened our understanding, as Julie was starting to mention, that in tumors that, while we don't identify a specific mutation, but they have evidence of homologous recombination deficiency or repair deficiency mechanisms, that those patients seem to also benefit from the agents. And so we've kind of broadened our understanding of how these drugs work with respect to a specific molecular annotation to a more broader sense of evidence of loss of homologous recombination deficiency. And of course, many of our studies in the recurrent setting and in the frontline setting have these drugs with a broad approval that isn't restricted to a biomarker. My personal opinion on that is that based on the mechanism of action that we understand for PARP inhibitors, we wouldn't expect a big treatment effect in patients that have intact homologous recombination machinery. So the fact that we have seen some activity in patients that are what we call homologous recombination test negative, essentially saying that their machinery is intact, is probably due to the false negatives of the testing. So less so about the biology and more so about the test. And so really kind of as we look to the future, I think we'll have a better handle on how to discriminate these patients based on updated analyses of how we evaluate for homologous recombination compliancy.
Now, Dr. Brown, you mentioned how, you know, your practice has changed. How specifically has it changed since the publication of the frontline maintenance trials?
Sure. I think that's really key, is sort of boots on the ground. What do we do? I think when we see patients up front, we immediately counsel them for testing. And in our practice, what's changed is that initially we may have only wanted genetic hereditary germline testing. But now we consistently send paired testing because we want to know both germline and somatic results up front. And ideally, we really want to know HRD status up front so that we can counsel patients on should they receive a PARP inhibitor immediately upon completion of their adjuvant paclitaxel carboplatin therapy, or potentially not if they're HR proficient. That too has changed in terms of if they're HR proficient, do we give them, say, niraparib based on the NOVA trial or not? And so really, I think that information is key. The downstream consequences of that really have to do with cascade testing. And what I mean by that is if a patient is germline positive, you're going to want to test all of their family to see if they have those mutations. And really that has long-term life-saving consequences for family members that may have a hereditary mutation in BRCA or related genes. But for the patient with ovarian cancer, tubal cancer, peritoneal cancer, we absolutely have to have that germline and somatic testing upfront so that we can counsel our patients appropriately and treat them with PARP inhibitors.
Dr. Coleman, anything to add in that regard?
I think she hit it right on the spot. You know, it doesn't take, you don't have to go back too many years to understand, you know, kind of this gap in genetics testing and you know, our ability to do something with the results. So prior to the initial approval of, you know, olaparib, which was the first drug approved in the setting in the recurrent BRCA positive patient population, we had prognostic information, and we knew that those patients had a potential genetic risk for personal risk for, you know, for breast cancer and the ovarian cancer patient population. And then also, as Jubilee mentioned, the family members. So it wasn't really until we had this link on using it as a predictive factor for therapy that it put a premium on testing. So, you know, it was, like I said, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, less than half of the patients in the United States were being tested for BRCA, just as Jubilee mentioned, and mostly it was just for germline. Now that we have this component that's related to the somatic events that are happening, not only in BRCA, but some of these other genes, and as I mentioned before, homologous recombination deficiency, that the testing kind of became like, you know, standard of care. It needed to be done in everybody. And so there, in the last couple of years, have been practice statements across the board that have said that this is absolutely part of the necessary requirements for newly diagnosed patients with ovarian cancer. So that's a sea change, you know, in a very short period of time. But it just goes to show you what the premium is on understanding what the genetic annotation of our patients are so that we can give them the best therapy as early as possible.
Yeah, and Rob, I'll just jump in there and echo what you say that, you know, this is all about patient outcomes. I mean, when was the last time we had something like this that really translated into just incredible patient outcomes? When you look at those curves, you know, in SOLO 1, they're completely separated, and that goes out as long as we know. That's just incredible.
Yeah, it's raising the new C word, cure.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that in a long time. So it's really exciting to see something new hit the horizon.
Lots of positive PARP trials, and now we have press release saying that the Ariel 4 study is also indeed positive. What are your thoughts on the top line findings that we've seen so far?
This is really amazing. Okay, so whenever we look at a trial and we sort of think in our heads about what might be the results, you know, here where we're comparing PARP inhibitors straight up with chemotherapy, personally, in my head, I was thinking that maybe they'll be equivalent, but the fact that there was a significant improvement in PFS in PARP inhibitors over chemotherapy in essentially all patients, even pretreated patients who might be platinum resistant. And that's pretty incredible. So I would say that this is a true game changer. And it also brings up reversion mutations because, you know, I think this is going to also change how we test our patients, because we now know that those are the only patients that really may not benefit from a PARP inhibitor. So it changes the testing that we need to consider. It changes how we treat patients in the recurrent setting. And wow, for platinum resistant patients, I can't wait to see the full data when it's presented.
You brought up another key point, and that's the reversion mutation. You know, because I think you asked a question earlier about like who should and shouldn't. So the shouldn'ts, as I mentioned, were the HR proficient. But I think the patients that have reversion mutation essentially are demonstrating proficiency in that mechanism. And in the Ariel 2 trial, we actually published on this, looking at what the response rate was to subsequent PARP in patients with reversion mutation. It's essentially zero. So here in Ariel 4, it was important as part of this trial to understand, actually eliminate or exclude patients who had evidence of a reversion mutation based on that evidence in Ariel 2. So here in the study with rucaparib, those patients were excluded, and that was 7%, which is pretty impressive. So if you think about the patients that went into the study, these are patients that had initially platinum-sensitive disease and could have been, as Julie mentioned, platinum-resistant, because they had to have received at least two prior lines of treatment. So in that sequence, and not be exposed to a PARP. So in that sequence of being, you know, either developing platinum resistance or having previous treatment with a platinum, we just have to, you know, see the final data. 7% of those patients actually had demonstration of reversion of their BRCA mutational status at the tissue level. So that's really impressive. And what's great about this type of study is it was done prospectively. So what it tells us is that as we think about how we test patients for whom we want to give a PARP inhibitor, now we have another kind of category that can help us to delineate who would be best, you know, a good candidate for this kind of medicine. So I think that's it brings a new dimension as to how we start to look at our treatment approach now that we have even better testing, as I mentioned, that will continue to be, developed over the next couple of years.
Then Dr. Coleman, would you say that receiving frontline PARP maintenance prevents patients from receiving treatment with PARP, or do we even have the data to know that?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and we don't have the data to know that yet. What I can tell you is that, as I mentioned before, the likelihood of a patient who had been on a PARP and responded and then progressed while taking a PARP and then getting a PARP in the future, those patients don't really respond. So the mechanisms for resistance are in place. What we don't know is what happens to patients who have received a PARP but didn't progress. And so that's actually the focus of a couple trials that are ongoing right now, including the Oreo trial, which is looking at that particular kind of sequence. And they're trying to stratify on the basis of the duration of time off of a PARP inhibitor, kind of how we think about platinum and being, quote, platinum sensitive with a recurrence. And again, those patients, as they go on to the Oreo trial, they're actually then put back on platinum sensitive platinum chemotherapy, looking for response and then randomizing to a PARP again. So they've been kind of pre-tested in two ways. One is that they are eligible for a PARP, and two, they've demonstrated continuous platinum sensitivity. So it's kind of another indirect biomarker of potential efficacy. So we'll learn. I mean, this is very important because, as Jubilee mentioned, most of our frontline trials in ovarian cancer have a part, at least as part of some part of the maintenance strategy. So most everybody who ends up in the recurrent setting will probably have seen a PARP at some point.
I think Rob covered that really beautifully. You know, to me, I think what's going to be important is exactly that. Many, if not most of our patients will see a PARP in the frontline setting. And so can we retreat those patients with a PARP in the recurrent setting as long as they don't progress up front? And, you know, my guess is going to be yes, based on this reversion mutation information that we have now with ARIEL4. But I think it's going to be really exciting to see what comes of that. And personally, now that I think this is where the details of the science really inform how we practice, you know, now that we have this information from ARIEL4 that patients responded so well, unless they had reversion mutations, I think that informs our testing. That now explains how we can treat patients in the recurrent setting with PARP inhibitors as long as they haven't progressed up front.
And a big question to close us out here, Dr. Brown, where would you say PARP inhibition is headed in ovarian cancer?
Oh, I think it is the game changer, actually. You know, it's the first time that we've had a new category of drugs that really impacts the patients. I would say really since paclitaxel, bevacizumab, as Rob said, or even potentially platinum. I mean, it's changed the world and our patients will benefit and potentially be cured.
Yeah, I think that this space has continued to evolve in a couple of ways. One is that we are looking at our existing therapies, for instance, anti-angiogenesis and immunotherapy as part of different maintenance strategies in annotated populations. So not only BRCA, but in BRCA wild type patients with different molecular characteristics. Those studies are nearly all enrolled. So we'll be looking to see how doublets and triplets in maintenance actually are going to impact these efficacy results as time goes on. And then of course, there are, as we already mentioned, a bunch of patients now that are ending up in the recurrent setting with a prior exposure or prior progression on PARP. And so some of those strategies are also targeted to overcoming the phenotype of PARP resistance or, you know, compliant homologous recombination. So trying to break that system to make these PARP inhibitors work again. And there's lots of strategies that are being investigated, like other pathways, like WEE1 pathway, and, you know, direct inhibitors of P53, different ATR. There's different processes that we're trying to impact to then restore the homologous recombination inefficiency so that PARPs might rework again. And so the big pile of trials that are ongoing, we're so excited to see them mature to see if this is a new opportunity for us as we continue to develop the space.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Clovis Oncology. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air. Editor's note: this podcast took place prior to the 2021 SGO Virtual Annual Meeting on